Hi, I'm Trip Gulick from Weill Cornell in New York City, and we're here to talk about HIV/AIDS 2026, The Basics. I have no disclosures. I do serve as the co-chair of the U.S. DHHS Adult and Adolescent ART Treatment Guidelines Panel, and I will be using those guidelines frequently throughout the presentation. The ID boards have about 15% of the questions that are focused on HIV, and you can see the breakdown here. Epidemiology, pathogenesis, and lab testing, each less than 2%. A major focus on HIV treatment regimens, about 4.5%, and opportunistic infections, about 5%. And then fewer questions on malignancies, other complications, and related issues. Regarding epidemiology, the first cases of what we now know as AIDS were described in 1981 in the CDC Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. And you can see that here, Pneumocystis pneumonia, Los Angeles. In the period October of 80 to May 81, five young men, all active homosexuals, were treated for biopsy-confirmed pneumocystis. What was unusual at the time, of course, was not pneumocystis that had been described previously, but only in people with profound immunosuppression. Why did these five young gay men have this opportunistic infection? We now know that these were the first five cases of AIDS ever described. So we go from five cases in 1981. In total, as of the latest data available, over 88 million people have been infected with HIV globally, and over half of them have died. This slide shows you the epidemiology of the world's HIV infections. You can see there are over 40 million people who are living currently with HIV worldwide. In orange and yellow are Africa. That accounts for about two-thirds of the world's HIV cases. But significant populations in Asia and the Pacific, shown in pink, Latin America, shown in red, and Europe and North America, shown in green. This slide shows the number of AIDS cases in the United States starting in the 1980s and then to the present day. AIDS is shown in blue and HIV-related deaths in green. You can see the peak years for both AIDS and death were the mid-1990s. And then you see a profound drop, about two-thirds in 2 years. That was coincident with the development of successful antiretroviral therapy. And you can see that both AIDS and death have decreased since that time. As people don't die from HIV or AIDS, they live with HIV, and that's what's shown in yellow, the prevalence of HIV infection. Currently, about 550,000 people ever diagnosed with AIDS are living in the United States. There are a total of 1.1 million people in total living with HIV. Here are the latest data available from the CDC. The year 2024. In that year, over 38,000 Americans were newly infected with HIV, and that trend, about 30,000 to 40,000, has been consistent in past years. You can see the breakdown by demographics and other factors. All populations are not equally affected. So men account for over three quarters of new HIV infections compared with women. Young people account for the majority of infections, as you can see, ages 13 to 44, although there are cases in older adults as well. When you look at race and ethnicity, Blacks and Latinos are overrepresented in terms of new cases compared to their proportion in the general population, as shown in blue. And in yellow at the bottom is area of the U.S. All areas are affected, but you can see that the U.S. South stands out with the highest rate of HIV infections in the U.S. When we look at risk behaviors, you can see that men who have sex with men, MSM, account for two-thirds of new infections in 2024. Heterosexual women account for 17% and heterosexual men for 8%, and then a smaller number of other risk groups, including injection drug users. Putting this all together, the population most at risk are young gay men of color. Here's a diagram of the cause of AIDS and HIV disease, human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. It was first called HTLV-3, human T-cell leukemia virus, back in the mid-80s, but quickly realized that it was not, in fact, a T-cell leukemia virus. It was isolated and discovered by two groups that are given co-credit for this, one in France and one in the U.S. HIV is a human retrovirus, and you can see has a relatively simple structure, an outer glycoprotein coat, and the green knobs are GP or glycoprotein 120. That's the docking glycoprotein. That's how HIV recognizes its target cell and binds to it. There's an inner triangular protein coat shown in orange here, and that encases the viral genetic material in the form of viral RNA. There are two strands of it, and in addition, viral-specific enzymes. There are two types of HIV worldwide. The most common by far is HIV-1. There's a second related virus called HIV-2, which is localized to Western Africa or countries with traditional ties, such as Spain, Portugal, and parts of India. There are also subtypes, also known as clades. These go by letters of the alphabet. Clade B is the most common in North America, Europe, and Australia, but there are a variety of clades in other parts of the world. HIV/AIDS is a zoonosis, that is a disease that started in animals and then jumped to people. This occurred from primates and likely occurred around the turn of the last century, around 1900, in Western Africa. The target cell for HIV is the CD4 positive T lymphocyte, or what our patients call the T cell. As you know, that is an important cell that regulates all other cellular functions in the immune system. Question one. Regarding testing, what is the current sequence of initial and confirmatory HIV diagnostic testing? Is it A, an ELISA followed by a Western blot, B, an ELISA followed by HIV RNA, C, ELISA followed by immunoassay, D, HIV RNA followed by Western blot, E, HIV RNA followed by ELISA, or F, HIV RNA followed by an immunoassay? Go ahead and vote. The correct answer is C, ELISA followed by an immunoassay. We no longer do the Western blot for HIV testing due to its complexity and expense. So HIV antibody testing is obviously an indirect way to test for the virus. We do the screening test, which is an ELISA, which looks for HIV-1 and HIV-2 antibodies. If this is repeatedly positive, we proceed to the confirmatory test, which is an immunoblot. In resource-poor settings, they may do a second HIV rapid test, a different type, and that also constitutes a sequential antibody testing. There are newer innovations, like a 20-minute oral test and a 1-minute blood test that test for antibodies. We can also test for HIV directly, looking for the virus. The test is the P24 antigen. That's one of the structures of the core protein of HIV. A research test is growing the virus in culture. And of course, we have the HIV RNA or viral load test. The current state of the art test is to use a combination antibody and antigen test. The window period, that is the time between exposure and a positive test, used to be as long as 3 months back in the day, now is shortened to as few as 2 weeks. Here's the CDC algorithm for testing today. As mentioned, we use the HIV-1-2 antigen-antibody combination immunoassay, or ELISA test. If that is negative, then you can tell your patient you are negative for HIV. Let's talk about ways to prevent it if you are at risk. If the ELISA is positive, it requires the second confirmatory test, which is an immunoassay. This will differentiate HIV-1 and HIV-2. You can see in the four cases listed here, in the first case, the immunoassay is positive for HIV-1. You have now made the diagnosis of HIV-1 infection. The second case, HIV-2 alone, that's a rare case. We occasionally see that in the United States. Even rarer is someone who is infected with both, although that can occur. And then in the fourth scenario here, the immunoassay is negative or indeterminate. And what do you do in that case? Then you have to proceed to an additional confirmatory test, the NAT or nucleic acid test, or in most cases, the viral load test. If that is negative, then your previous testing shows a false positive test. And that can occur for a variety of reasons. If it's positive, you have just diagnosed acute HIV infection. That is so early that the antibodies have not yet had the chance to form, but the viral RNA readily detectable. And that person should be referred for counseling and treatment. Here's a sequence of the various tests that we use to diagnose HIV over time. Again, someone who's infected at time zero, there will be a window period where no test is positive, and that can occur for about 14 days. The first test to become positive is the viral RNA or viral load test. The second test is the P24 antigen used in the antigen antibody test, and that is at approximately 18 days. The ELISA becomes positive at 3 weeks, and then Western blot, which we no longer use, is a later test. So the earliest test to become positive is the viral load test. Question two, who should not be routinely offered HIV testing? A, a 32-year-old pregnant woman in a stable relationship. B, a 23-year-old sexually active monogamous gay man. C, a 75-year-old former injection drug user. D, a 10-year-old prepubescent girl. Or E, all of them should be routinely offered HIV testing. Go ahead and vote. The correct answer is the 10-year-old prepubescent girl who is at no risk for HIV and does not need to be tested. Everyone else listed here has some risk and should be tested. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force published formal recommendations for HIV testing some time ago, and the recommendations say screen all adolescents and adults ages 15 to 65 for HIV infection at least once. Point two, screen all pregnant women with every pregnancy, and these days, several times within pregnancy. And then they go on to say younger adolescents under 15 and older adults over 65 who are at increased risk should also be screened. This is a grade A recommendation, which means high certainty that the net benefit is substantial. And grade A services, according to federal rule, private insurance and Medicare must offer these tests without a copay. What are the risks of transmission from HIV from various sources? So a blood transfusion from someone living with HIV transfused into another individual is a high risk of transmission, about 9 in 10 or about 90% per exposure from a transfusion. Of course, we screen the blood supply today. Needle sharing through injection drug use occurs in transmission in about 1 in 167 times or 0.6% risk. A percutaneous needle stick, so most often in an occupational exposure, is about 1 in 500 occasions will result in seroconversion, or about 0.2. That's in the absence of prophylaxis. And then there's sex. So the most risky sexual behavior is receptive anal sex. So the positive partner insertive and the other person receptive. That will result in seroconversion, one in about 70 exposures, or 1.4%. Insertive anal sex, so roles are flipped. The insertive partner is the HIV negative and the receptive partner HIV positive, much less likely, about 1 in 1,000 exposures will result in seroconversion. Receptive penile vaginal sex, so if the positive partner is insertive, about 1 in 1,250. And insertive penile vaginal sex, where the vaginal receptive partner is positive, 1 in 2,500 exposures. Oral sex, a question that comes up, difficult to quantitate, but is thought to be low or very low in terms of exposure. And then mother-to-child transmission, so a mother living with HIV to her child during pregnancy, about 1 in 4, 23%. That's in the absence of administering any kind of prophylaxis. Here's the time course of untreated HIV infection. So someone becomes infected at time zero, and let's walk through this. So in green is viremia, so measured by the viral load test. Some of the highest levels will occur in acute infection. You can see millions of copies of HIV RNA per cc of blood. The highest I've ever seen is 14 million. That will be reduced outside of acute infection, but in the absence of treatment, always detectable and can reach high levels in late stage infection. In blue are the CD4 cell counts in blood. A person who is just infected would have a normal CD4 cell count considered above 400 cells per microliter of blood. This can dip during acute infection. It can actually dip below 200 on occasion, but then will rebound. But over the course of the infection, as HIV infects the CD4 cells and destroys them, the number of CD4 cells will decline over time. When a person reaches a CD4 cell count in the blood of 200 per microliter, we consider them to have profound immunosuppression, and they have now met the case definition of AIDS. Again, in the absence of treatment, CD4 cell counts will continue to decline. The lowest I've ever seen was 0 per microliter of blood. In purple are the mucosal CD4 cells, so this is gut-associated lymph tissue. Again, these start out at a normal level, but within several weeks of acute infection, are reduced about 80 to 90%, and in the absence of treatment, never recover during the course of the illness. Finally, in red is immune activation. HIV is a potent stimulator of immune responses. Many of these will be negative immune responses, so they can cause immune activation and inflammation. And this, in the absence of treatment, is tied to end organ disease, including heart, liver, and kidney. I want to emphasize this graph shows untreated HIV infection. Treatment substantially changes the factors that you see here. The CDC adult AIDS case definition was initially coined in 1982. AIDS, or the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, was a list of diseases and disqualifying conditions. So those disqualifying conditions were other forms of immunosuppression, such as cancer, organ transplantation, or steroid therapy. This was a syndrome because we didn't know the cause. And as I said before, the cause of HIV was discovered AIDS was discovered in 1983, 1984. Why do we still call it a syndrome? Well, the name just stuck. So we still call it AIDS today, although we know the cause of the syndrome. After discovery of the virus in 1985, HIV antibody testing was added to the definition. So not only a specific immunosuppressive disease, but presence of the antibody as measured in the blood. In 1987, additional presumptive diagnoses were added, such as tuberculosis, cervical cancer, and repeated bacterial pneumonias. And in 1993, the current definition was having a positive HIV antibody test and a CD4 cell count less than 200, regardless of symptoms. And that constitutes the CDC definition of AIDS. Once defined or diagnosed with AIDS, a person retains that diagnosis for life, even if they respond to antiretroviral and recover their CD4 cell counts. The complication of AIDS, as you know, opportunistic infections. These are infections caused by an organism capable of causing disease only in a host whose resistance is lowered by other diseases such as HIV, cancer, autoimmune disease, or by drugs like cancer chemotherapy and steroids. The AIDS-related opportunistic infections are broad and listed for you here. Bacterial, the most common ones are Mycobacterium avium complex, and the most common opportunistic infection in the world is MTB or tuberculosis. Fungal diseases include pneumocystis, cryptococcus, and histoplasmosis. Viral, CMV, cytomegalovirus. Parasitic, most commonly toxoplasma and diarrheal illnesses. And malignancies, opportunistic malignancies, Kaposi sarcoma, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We can adjust our diagnosis and our differential diagnosis of someone with HIV by knowing what their CD4 cell count is and knowing which opportunistic infections occur at which CD4 thresholds. So as stated before, a normal CD4 cell count is above 400. The only pathogens that would cause disease in someone with HIV with a CD4 count above 400 would be the most aggressive. So herpes zoster, candida, EBV causing oral leukoplakia, bacterial pneumonia such as streptococcus pneumoniae, and then tuberculosis. You can see these at any CD4 cell count, but that's really what's limited above 400. As you go below 200, that's where we see the opportunistic pathogens causing disease. Pneumocystis, PCP or PJP pneumonia occurs below a CD4 count of 200. Toxoplasmosis and cryptococcosis below a CD4 count of 100. And Mycobacterium avium complex and CMV below a CD4 count of 50. So the CD4 count does help you with the differential diagnosis. As mentioned, antiretroviral therapy changes the natural history of HIV disease. What's our goal with treatment? It's to suppress the HIV RNA or the viral load level as low as possible for as long as possible. If we can do that, we can preserve or enhance immune function. And if we can do that, we can delay clinical progression of HIV disease and prolong healthy survival. When should we start antiretroviral therapy? Guidelines are consistent at this point. This lists the two major ones we consult in the U.S. I mentioned the U.S. DHHS guidelines, which are updated real time with the web address that you see there, updated last fall. And the alternative are the International Antiviral Society USA guidelines. They are updated in JAMA every other year, last updated in 2025. If you wanted to read one article about antiretroviral therapy, that's the article to read. The guidelines are consistent here and across the world in saying anyone with AIDS or symptomatic HIV or asymptomatic, regardless of CD4 cell count, we should offer treatment. So essentially, anyone living with HIV should be offered antiretroviral treatment in 2026. The guidelines say ART is recommended for all persons to decrease morbidity and mortality and to prevent transmission of HIV to others. And the guidelines go on to say initiate ART immediately or as soon as possible after HIV diagnosis. Once you've decided to treat, the next question is what to treat with. Currently in 2026, we have 36 drugs that have been approved by the FDA for the treatment of HIV, starting with AZT back in 1987. You can see a series of drugs listed here, listed with their three-letter codes. The most recently approved drug was just a few months ago, is Latrivir, ISL. So we have lots of choices. How do antivirals work? Well, they throw roadblocks up in the life cycle of HIV, and that's shown for you here. So here's the virus, as we previously saw, with its outer glycoprotein coat, its inner coat encasing the genetic material, the viral RNA. HIV recognizes and binds to its target cell, the CD4 T cell, by binding through its external membrane protein, GP120, to the CD4 receptor. That's the first step of infection by HIV. Binding allows binding to a second receptor called the co-receptor or chemokine receptor. Most commonly, that's CCR5, occasionally CXCR4. When both of those receptors have been bound, that allows fusion of the viral membrane with the host cell membrane. The contents of the viral particle are extruded into the cytoplasm of the cell. So the core particles are released into the cytoplasm and then transported into the nucleus of the cell. While that transport is occurring, reverse transcription of the viral RNA is occurring. So a viral-specific enzyme, reverse transcriptase, is taking the viral RNA sequences and making viral DNA copies of them. When the central particle reaches the nucleus, it enters into the nucleus, and the capsid particle here, the core particle, uncoats, releases the viral genetic material and HIV enzymes into the nucleus of the cell. The HIV, now in the form of viral DNA, can be integrated or inserted into the host cell genome. This is done through a viral-specific enzyme called HIV integrase. At the point of integration, this cell is now infected for life, and an infected CD4 cell can live approximately 60 years or a good portion of the lifespan of the individual. The cell may remain in a latent form, but it and would be silent to the immune system, but can be activated, and the genes of the cell, along with the viral genes, can be transcribed to RNA, translated into viral proteins. These assemble at the surface of the cell and bud off into new viral particles. The last step in the maturation of these particles is a protein cleaving action caused by a viral enzyme called HIV protease. And that step is necessary for full maturation and infectiousness of the viral particle. When enough of the viral particles have budded off from the cell integrity is lost. And when enough CD4s are lost, the immune system becomes compromised and people get sick. So the whole approach to treating this infection is to throw up roadblocks in this life cycle. The first drugs we have targeted HIV reverse transcriptase. These are the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, either looking like the DNA bases, so nucleoside analogs, or not, known as the non-nucleoside analogs or reverse transcriptase inhibitors, or NNRTIs. The third class of drugs targeted that very last step in the life cycle, so inhibit the HIV protease. These are the protease inhibitors. Drug development continued. We had the first HIV entry inhibitor, which inhibited fusion, a chemokine receptor inhibitor, which inhibited binding to CCR5, and a CD4 attachment inhibitor. So all three steps of HIV entry inhibited. Then came the HIV integrase inhibitors, inhibiting that integration step in the middle of the life cycle. And the most recent class to be approved is the first HIV capsid inhibitor, which inhibits both capsid uncoating and reassembly. Here are the approved antiretroviral agents, this time sorted by class. The column on the left are the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, the nucleosides up top and the non-nucleosides on the bottom. In the middle are the HIV protease inhibitors and the HIV integrase inhibitors. And on the right, three types of HIV entry inhibitors and the first capsid inhibitor. If you counted these up, you'll note that this is not 36 drugs. In fact, 9 antiretrovirals have been discontinued from the market, so are no longer available. Why? Because they were either toxic, inconvenient, or less potent than the drugs we use today. We use combination therapy to treat HIV. And why do we do that? It's shown for you here. Back in the 80s, we had a single drug, AZT. We could reduce the viral load level. This is on a log scale. So we could reduce that 90%, but the virus rebounded. And if you characterize viruses here, they were now resistant to AZT. In the mid-1990s, we had 2 nucleosides. That could reduce the viral load level 99%, but again, rebound occurred. And now some of these viruses were resistant to both drugs. Things changed in the late 1990s when we began to use triple combination potent therapy with 2 nucleosides and a protease inhibitor. You can see we completely suppress HIV replication now below the limit of detection, and that provides durable virologic suppression. We now know this is 6-month data. We now know we can do that for decades. When we reduce the viral load level, CD4 cell counts will recover. Question 3, which class of antiretroviral therapy, ART, is recommended as the basis for initial HIV treatment for most patients? Is it A, all nucleoside analog, B, non-nucleoside analog reverse transcriptase inhibitor-based regimen, C, protease inhibitor-based regimen, D, integrase inhibitor-based regimen, or E, entry inhibitor-based regimen? Go ahead and vote. The answer is D, integrase inhibitor-based regimens. These have risen to the top because of their potency, convenience, and tolerability. The DHHS guidelines help us in determining which are the recommended initial regimens for someone with HIV starting therapy. The basic outline is 1 or 2 nucleoside analogs combined with an integrase inhibitor, and only 2 integrase inhibitors are among the recommended regimens, either bictegravir or dolutegravir, each of those combined with nucleoside analogs. Bictegravir is actually co-formulated with tenofovir alafenamide, the newer form, and emtricitabine, also known as FTC. That's 1 pill once a day. Dolutegravir needs to be combined with 2 nucleosides as well, so either FTC or lamivudine, 3TC, and either TAF or the older form of tenofovir, tenofovir disoproxil fumarate, or TDF. Those would be 3 drug combinations. A 2 drug combination is also recommended among preferred regimens. That's dolutegravir co-formulated with 3TC. And then finally, with prior cabotegravir, that's another integrase inhibitor, used injectably for PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, because of the concern for integrase inhibitor resistance between cabotegravir and either BIC or dolutegravir, the recommended regimen should be a boosted darunavir regimen with 2 nucleoside analogs. Alternative regimens include the nucleoside analog abacavir or non-nucleoside or protease inhibitor-based regimens. But nucleoside analogs are the preferred initial regimens together with an integrase inhibitor. Single tablet regimens have really become popular. They were first developed in 2006, 2 nucleosides with the NNRTI efavirenz. Now you can see we have 1 pill regimens for a whole lot of combination antiretroviral regimens. These include other NNRTIs, protease inhibitors, and integrase inhibitors. Several of these marked with a star are only indicated for people who have suppressed on other regimens and then switched to these. And this includes the recently approved islatravir-doravirine combination. Another approach to therapy is an all-injectable regimen. This makes use of the integrase inhibitor cabotegravir. This is a drug similar to dolutegravir, but it is available as an injectable form using a nanotechnology formulation. Phase 3 studies used intramuscular cabotegravir combined with an intramuscular form of rilpivirine, the non-nucleoside, used as a treatment switch for people who were successfully taking oral treatment regimens with virologic suppression. The all-injectable regimen in 2 big studies showed non-inferiority, and that led to FDA approval back in 2021. So this is for patients who are undetectable on their oral antivirals with no history of virologic failure, drug resistance, or chronic hepatitis B, because cabotegravir has no activity against hepatitis B. Innovations and amendments included not monthly dosing, but every other month dosing, which is considered the standard of care, with the all-injectable regimen and an optional oral lead-in. Antiretroviral therapy has led to profound changes in HIV deaths and consequently HIV life expectancy. These are older data, but show in the dotted line, HIV-related deaths from 2010 to 2018 decreased by nearly 50%. And you can see that mirrors total deaths in the solid blue line. What hasn't really changed are non-HIV-related deaths. These are common causes of death in all adults and include both cancer and cardiovascular disease. And you can see that really hasn't changed over the decade shown for you here. As people don't die from HIV, they live with HIV. And that has led to a life expectancy of someone with HIV who takes their antiretrovirals nearly that of the general population. These are some data to back that up. This is looking at the life expectancy of someone with HIV on antivirals for at least a year after 2015. So modern regimens, who was age 40 in North America and Europe. And they used 2 large cohort studies to model this data. So over 200,000 people and over 5,700 deaths. Women on the left, men on the right. The first thing to notice is the average life expectancy in the general population for a 40-year-old woman in Europe and North America. She will live an additional 45 plus years. And a man will live an additional 40 years, so into their 80s. And then what's broken down for you here is by CD4 cell count. So let's focus on the best case scenario, someone with a normal count above 500. And what you can see for women is that heterosexual women really approaching life expectancy for the general population. Injection drug users have other challenges and their life expectancy a bit lower. When you look at men, you can see men who have sex with men, shown in the darker blue, the life expectancy is the same of someone with HIV taking their therapy as the general population. Heterosexual men in light blue right next to it. And again, injection drug users with more challenges having a lower life expectancy. So this is a powerful message for our patients with HIV. If you take your meds, you can expect to have a normal life expectancy. HIV prevention is a strategy that is increasingly employed. We've always known how to prevent this since the 1980s. It was as simple as ABC, abstain from sex, be faithful with your HIV negative partner, or use condoms and get counseled and tested. That worked for many people, but not everyone. We now have a whole additional alphabet of prevention strategies. Male circumcision, so removing the foreskin, which has a lot of CD4 cell counts, reduces the risk of men acquiring HIV infection by about 40%. 3 different studies conducted in Africa, and that's a strategy being rolled out. Diaphragms for women with antiretrovirals in the diaphragm did not work. Much more effective is exposure prophylaxis with antiretrovirals. So using antivirals not only for treatment, but for prevention. And in many different scenarios, that will prevent acquiring HIV. And we'll go into more detail about that. The rest of the alphabet, not so successful. So female-controlled microbicides, these are substances with antivirals inside, have mixed results. No proven microbicide actually works. And controlling genital tract infections, or HSV2, has not been successful, and there is no effective HIV vaccine today. Question four, which PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis regimen, is FDA approved for at-risk men and women? Is it daily tenofovir disoproxil fumarate, TDF, emtricitabine, FTC? B, daily tenofovir allafenamide, TAF, with FTC? C, on-demand TDF, FTC? D, on-demand TAF, FTC? Or all of the above? Let's vote. The correct answer is A, TDF, FTC. This is the only FDA-approved regimen for PrEP for both men and women. Choice B, TAF FTC, is approved for men, likely works for women, but is not FDA approved. On demand, again, likely works for TDF FTC, but is not FDA approved. On demand TAF FTC has never been studied. So PrEP is a prevention strategy that we're using today. This is the strategy of administering antivirals to uninfected at-risk individuals. And obviously, when you're choosing a drug for prevention, it needs to be potent, safe, tolerable, and convenient. So we use the combined co-formulated pill, either form of tenofovir with FTC, and more recently, injectable PrEP with either the integrase inhibitor cabotegravir, or even more recently, the capsid inhibitor lenacapavir. FDA approved TDF FTC back in 2012, TAF FTC for men only 2019, and more recently, cabotegravir in 2021 and subcutaneous lenacapavir given every 6 months in 2025. The PrEP studies show that these drugs work. An older study called PROUD studied over 500 men who have sex with men, randomized them to PrEP versus no PrEP, and PrEP was associated with an 86% reduction in the risk of HIV infection. HIV Prevention Trials Network 083 enrolled MSM globally, very large study, randomized them to oral PrEP versus injectable CAB given every 2 months, cabotegravir. And cabotegravir was associated with a 66% reduction over that seen with TDF-FTC, just showing that adherence is important and injectables can speak to that. And then more recently, the PURPOSE study, there was one in women, a second one published in men, randomized to oral PrEP regimens versus subcutaneous lenacapavir given every 6 months. And lenacapavir was significantly better than oral PrEP. In fact, zero infections in this study. So PrEP works, and we should be offering it. What about vaccines? One slide. You can see that thousands of people have been enrolled in HIV vaccine studies with a number of different approaches, trying to stimulate either antibody or cytotoxic T lymphocytes or both. Unfortunately, the track record really shows none of these were very effective. One had a 31% decrease. So the search for effective HIV vaccines continues. Lastly, HIV cure. How many people have been cured? And the answer is this person, Timothy Ray Brown, was the first patient considered cured of HIV. He was a San Franciscan living in Berlin who was doing well on antivirals and then developed leukemia, AML, was recommended for a bone marrow transplant to cure his AML, needed to go off antiviral therapy, and his viral load rose over that time. He got total body irradiation chemotherapy, was given a bone marrow transplant from a donor lacking the receptor for the chemokine receptor, one of the critical steps of the HIV life cycle. He rejected that marrow, was given anti-rejection meds, and then a second bone marrow transplant. And when all was said and done, he remained off antivirals and had no detectable viral load and a CD4 cell count, which reached back to normal levels. He was followed for another 9 years and never showed evidence of HIV and is considered the first person cured of HIV. Unfortunately, died recently due to recurrence of his leukemia. Is this unusual? Yes, but there have been over 10 cases reported worldwide, including the first Latino, the first woman, this is at my own institution, and a number of additional cases seen worldwide. So while we will not be rolling out bone marrow transplant as an effective therapy to cure HIV, it has stimulated research on how to do that procedure, but more safely. In conclusion, HIV/AIDS is a worldwide pandemic. We should offer testing to all patients. Antivirals decrease viral load, increase CD4 cells, prevent disease progression, and prolong healthy survival. Current therapy consists of 2 or 3 drug therapy and is available worldwide, most often integrase inhibitor-based therapy. Current life expectancy for someone with HIV on treatment is now approaching or equal to that of the general population. Prevention continues to be key with PrEP and PEP, and cure research is in progress. I will stop there, and thanks for your attention.